Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, mutant name Hello Poddo, and welcome to this very special Empire podcast dedicated to X-Men Days of Future Past, the latest, and some might say best, installment in the X-Men franchise. Joining me today to discuss all things X is our team of resident geeks. Helen O'Hara, mutant name?
I don't know, Geekella?
Geekella? It's more of a sort of Robert E. Howard-y name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's good. That's good. That's good with Geekella. Empire Girl, how about that? Like the Jean Grey
type works.
Thing.
Or Captain Empire, I prefer actually. Way that, you know, Marvel Girl became Captain Marvel.
Captain Empire. Ali Plum is also here. What's your mutant name?
Editor,
because you edit the podcast. Okay. And last but not least, James Dyer. What's your mutant name, Jimbo?
Absolutely no clue.
Anyway, moving on. As ever, on our spoiler specials, we're going to discuss everything and anything in the film, from major third act plot developments and post-credits things, post-credits things, you have to wait a long time for this one, to Easter eggs galore. So if you haven't seen Days of Future Past, get to your nearest cinema. You can teleport there or have Quicksilver give you a lift if you would like. Watch it and then come back here and listen to everything. But first, before we do that, Helen and I sat down with Days of Future Past writer and producer Simon Kinberg. We shook him upside down and watched all sorts of lovely X secrets fall out of his X pockets. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined in the pod booth by Simon Kinberg, writer-producer of X-Men Days of Future Past, the man with who this whole shebang began.
Began with Chris Claremont before me, but certainly the movie version began with me.
But if you travel back in time to write it before Chris Claremont.
If I travel back in time, I'd ask Chris Claremont to make it slightly less complicated.
Was this the hardest script you ever had to write?
This is the hardest script I have ever had to write in so many different ways. The time travel element itself is, you know, mind-bending, dizzying in terms of keeping the logic of that straight, avoiding all of the things you would imagine, like the paradoxes and time loops. So then you add to that, which would be its own challenging movie, like, you know, Terminator Back to the Future, where you have one hero and you add a cast of 8 to 10 to 12 main characters, any four or five of which have to have really fleshed out, defined emotional stories for Oscar-winning or nominated actors. A couple, you know, types of robots, and it's a very challenging screenplay.
So presumably you just said final draft to auto write, took the weekend off, and when you came back, it was complete.
I think even final draft got confused over the span of this movie, to the point at which I actually had to start putting in the slug lines, interior, whatever the location was, night or day, and then dash past or dash future. So people reading the script would not, you know, get confused as to, is this the Magneto from the future, the past? And then I would also name characters different names in past and future. So the older versions in the script are Magneto and Professor Xavier. The younger versions are Eric and Charles.
I noticed that in the credits. I was going to ask you about that. So yeah, that makes sense.
Comes from the script. And in fact, in some cases, where a specific case with Wolverine, just to make that clear also for the audience, because that's not for the audience, for the reader, Wolverine's in the future, Logan's in the past. But as credited, I don't even know how they credit him. One man gets the credit for that.
Absolutely. And we've talked in the past about the decision to change the comic book in terms of Shadowcat goes back to Wolverine. It must help the fact that Hugh Jackman doesn't look a day older than he did when he started this 15 years ago.
Yeah, well, that does help. And, you know, the biggest decision and the biggest place we diverged, obviously, from the original books is in who gets sent back in time. And when we first started talking about it, we really wanted it to be someone's consciousness being sent back in time rather than their body. And if you send Ellen Page's consciousness back to the era of Michael Fassbender and Jen Lawrence in the 70s, she's like negative 20 years old. So immediately we realized it wasn't going to be pre-ghost of Ellen Page, so it had to be somebody else. And Wolverine seems like the immediate sort of reflex obvious person to choose, but it wasn't for us, maybe because we're not that smart. But Matthew Vaughn and I, who was the director at the time and with whom I developed the screenplay initially, we explored the notion of Bishop being sent back, Cable being sent back, a new character being sent back, who we could cast old and then cast sort of in the more prominent part of his life as a new young actor. And somewhere in that process, we just looked at each other, and I really don't remember when it was, to be honest, and just said, well, we have a character who doesn't age and happens to be the most popular character in the movie franchise. And as Hugh Jackman almost literally hasn't aged, it then became Wolverine we sent back in time.
Nice and simple.
Yeah, like everything on this movie.
But you still got this huge kind of meaty bromance to deal with at both ends of the timeline between Charles and Eric, Magneto and Professor X. So figuring out the beats of that must have been, again, quite a job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the decisions we made when we started working on X-Men First Class was that it would be the story, and I guess this is true of the original X-Men movies in some way too, but it would be the story of Charles and Eric's friendship, and then enmity, and then friendship again. That bromance is that's the sort of the pillars of the comic, even if Wolverine and Cyclops and other characters sort of come to the fore in the books and then in the movies, in the case of Wolverine. It's the Charles and Eric story. And so when we made First Class, it was literally the Charles and Eric story. You know, you were watching these two guys go from being strangers to friends to enemies. And that was the architecture of that film. So in this one, we wanted to obviously continue that story, deepen that story, shake that story up a little bit. And what we tell in this story is essentially these two guys who've been become estranged. You know, they were friends and they were estranged, have a moment of connection sort of on their way to, you know, this mission together in Paris, where the audience and perhaps the characters themselves think, oh, we're going to come back together. And then because of the things that happen in Paris and Eric sort of defaulting to what makes Eric Eric, they split apart again.
Yeah.
And by the end of the film, there's this sort of truce between them, and they go their separate ways, and perhaps we'll go on to be enemies, and perhaps we'll go on to be friends. I mean, one of the things so interesting about those characters is that the friendship and enmity is meshed together, woven together, in a way that's so much more complex than the way heroes and villains are in most comics, and most movies.
The other sort of, I guess, big kind of character arc, big media character arc, apart from those two and Wolverine, is Mystique, because that is a role she, I mean, you know, I think Bryan Singer described her once in Chris's feature as the MacGuffin of the piece, and she kind of is, but at the same time, you've got to give her reasons for everything that she does, and that's a tough job, because there's some big shifts.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that, you know, Mystique's role in the movie really evolved, I would say, over the span, not just of the first draft, but subsequent drafts and working with Bryan Singer. She was always the MacGuffin of the movie. It was always that they were going back in time to stop her from doing something. But that could sort of go two ways. One is if they just physically had to stop her, then she's just the physical MacGuffin of the movie and doesn't really have an emotional arc of her own. She's just doggedly trying to do the same thing for the entire movie, and then the heroes physically stop her, and that's the end of the film. Somewhere in the process of working with Bryan, we came up with the idea that it's not just enough to physically stop her, because then she could just keep doing it again and again and again. They had to emotionally or philosophically stop her and make it feel at the end of the movie that she was making the decision to stop and that she had changed in a way such that she would not go on to kill again. And so once you have that as a sort of destination for the character, then you can backtrack and start to fill in the arc that gets her there.
So this brings me to a much bigger question that I have. Are any of the other X movies now canon? Because this seems to have changed everything. Because like if Mystique is not a killer, then that changes the very first X-Men, never mind the rest.
There's no question that at the end of Days of Future Past, there are events that have happened in 1973 that did not happen in our accepted real 1973, and as such, ripple into the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s when X1 would take place. And we acknowledge that at the end of the movie. I mean, Wolverine wakes up in the quote-unquote future, and it is a future that is similar to the future of X1 through 3, but has some very distinct differences as well. And so for us, it was this feeling of, and we talk maybe too much in the movie about this sort of notion of time travel or time continuity, where the river of time keeps going in the same sort of current in the same direction, but you can actually shift it just a little bit. You can, you know, throw a pebble in and see at least the splash of the pebble. So by the end of our movie, we want to feel like the current is still going in the same direction, which is Charles went off and started a school and started the X-Men, but the way he did it, and maybe some of the people who are part of the X-Men, are not exactly the same.
Did you and Bryan sit down and figure out exactly the details of that? For example, we saw Rogue, Anna Paquin, at the very end, the very end of the movie. So presumably the offense of X1, Wolverine meets Rogue, takes her to the school, they wind up at the school. That happens, but Jean doesn't die, for example. So how detailed did you go in terms of that stuff?
Bryan and I spent a lot of time talking about what we were going to honor and what we were going to challenge or even, you know, nullify from the original movies. And one of the things that I personally felt very strongly about was that Jean would be alive at the end of the movie. And Cyclops, partly out of just personal guilt from having worked on X3. And there are many things in X3 that I'm very proud of and that I think are good. And there's many things that I would do differently.
Yeah.
Almost if I could have gone back in time from now, like and talked to my younger self, and said many lessons I've learned in the 10 years that have come since. But I, for personal reasons and as a fan, frankly, who was disappointed in the way that Scott was killed in X3 sort of unceremoniously, you know, in some ways disappointed with the personification of Dark Phoenix in X3. I felt like seeing them at the end of the movie would be both personally and generally for a wide audience very satisfying.
I, as someone who has frequently used a hashtag on Twitter, Justice for Cyclops. I was delighted to see Scott turn up at the end. And I think that's going to get a huge cheer. I haven't seen it with an audience.
I think everybody's a little stunned when they see Jean, and then they take a moment to recover, and then the comedy of Scott sort of allows them to exhale, and then they applaud his presence.
But it's a nice idea that Professor X would learn from his own mistakes that he's seen in Logan's future, even in the sort of the original timeline, and maybe wouldn't treat Jean in the same way, so that she wouldn't necessarily go the same
way. Well,
you know,
there's, I will say that this movie is as intricate as any movie that I've ever worked on. I mean, the amount of jigsaw, you know, puzzle pieces. It's one of those jigsaw puzzles that you look back at and you're like, oh, it doesn't look that complicated. Then you like start to look more closely and it's millions of pieces, you know, that are stitched together. One of those pieces that I was very conscious of when I was writing, knowing that I wanted Jean to come back at the end of the movie, I wanted young Charles to see essentially X3. Mm-hmm. And so there's that moment when he's looking into Wolverine's mind where Wolverine is helping him sort of meet his older self. And we could have done anything there. We could have just had him immediately see what Wolverine wanted him to see, which is that, you know, inner sanctum of the monastery. But I thought it was an opportunity to warn, essentially, without intentionally warning. It's just he's going through Logan's mind and his most prominent memories would be those of Jean. It's an opportunity to warn young Charles of this thing that's coming that he can do something to avoid.
It's really interesting as well. You also have that line earlier on when Logan on the jet says to Charles, remember these names, Storm, Scott, Jean, look them up. Mm-hmm. So in a way, are you setting that in motion?
Yeah.
Are you saying that Charles wouldn't necessarily go look for these mutants?
Well, I think he would have, because he did in X1-3, but the 1973 that preceded X-Men 1 is different than the 1973 that was, you know, the world that young Charles Xavier was in, you know, from the moment that Wolverine woke up in the past. So I wanted to almost, and I think the character in Wolverine wanted to ensure that he would do it. Not assuming that he wouldn't, but you never know because time has shifted a little bit because that you don't know where those ripples are going to ripple out to. He wanted to be sure. And there's a moment in that, it's one of my favorite performance moments in the movie, where you just said when Wolverine says, when Logan says, you know, Scott, Storm, and then he pauses and says Jean. And it's like in the pause and the weight of the word Jean, I feel like if you don't know anything about the franchise, you have no idea who Jean is, you just understand he had a complicated sad relationship with this person named Jean.
Absolutely. Am I right in thinking as well that we see a version of Jean before Famke Janssen appears? There's a young redheaded girl who looks up at the stadium as it floats over.
In 1973, the young redheaded girl could indeed be a young Jean.
Thinking, that looks cool. I'll do something like that one day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, who knows, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it's also interesting when you bring Scott and Jean back at the end, because there's a moment of comedy, as you said, but there's also a weird... it's always been a strange triangle, that their relationship. And you see how much Logan's invested in Jean. At that point, I guess she doesn't really have the same feelings for him, and certainly Scott's there, and he's probably not aware of how strongly Logan feels about Jean.
Well, I don't know. You know, one of the ways I wrote the scene was that some of the dynamics from X1, 2, and 3, but especially X1 and 2, are still in place, which is Logan's in love with Jean. Jean has this attraction toward him because you watch in this movie as Famke sort of slides away from Hugh, there's like a little bit of a body brush and a sense that, you know, it's not exactly like, you know, passing your brother. Scott is territorial about Jean and grabs Logan's hand when Logan tries to touch her. So I think some of that stuff, the conflict between Scott and Logan that was so great in the original X-Men movies, the sort of attraction, repulsion or attraction fear between Jean and Logan, you know, in the span of whatever that is, a 45-second scene, we were trying to give it that kind of life.
I love that it's like the remember at the end of Wayne's World, they did the Scooby-Doo ending and then they did the super happy ending. It was kind of the super happy ending, you know?
It is. No, and we, by the way, we talked about it when we were making it, that was the Happy Mansion sequence. And we brought in, you know, we brought in Beast late.
I was going to say, now, was that Kelsey Grammer actually in the makeup or did he just do the voice?
That was Kelsey Grammer in the makeup.
In the makeup, cool. Yeah.
Was there talk of any other cameos or did anything?
No, because at a certain point it started to feel a little bit like, you know, Mad World or, you know, you didn't want to go too far deep into it. Those seemed like the organic people. I knew from the beginning it was going to be Gene and Scott. It was one of the things I was most clear and to be honest, most adamant about from the beginning of the writing process. And I was sort of on my own in the writing process. So I was allowed to do that. And Hank was a natural thing that evolved and didn't come really until production, the idea of having him at the end, because we say young Hank, Nick, doesn't survive in the future. So we wanted to say, well, the future's been changed. And there was something, he's such a sweet young character, young Hank, that we wanted to feel like part of what they'd salvage in the future is his life.
Fantastic. Not to dwell too much on the ending, but it is a reboot. In many ways, which I love about it. And it seems to me you can almost go in two directions now. You can almost have, it's a plan really to have two concurrent franchises in a way. You could have the younger cast, and you have set the bar. You've reset it now, so we could have an original X-Men cast movie again.
Yeah, we could. I mean, we definitely could go in either direction, in truth, most likely. And I pray to God we never do another cross-generational time travel extravaganza, because I just think my brain would implode. You know, the plan right now, at least for the next movie with Apocalypse, is to primarily focus on the first-class cast. Mm-hmm. Because there's still so much, and obviously there's plenty of room for the older characters, the original characters, to grow forward. Mm-hmm. But there's still so much growth to happen between, you know, where the first class characters are at the end of Days of Future Past and where we know they end up, how the twists and turns potentially take them into being leaders and, you know, villains and a lot of other everything in between. That's sort of interesting, for at least for me creatively, to explore. So the definitely the focus right now is on the first class cast going forward, with some visitation from the, let's say, original characters.
Because we have, I mean, what isn't 100% clear from that, you know, Happy Mansion ending, is what's happened to Magneto and Mystique, because they're obviously not anywhere in that scene. So their fates remain maybe a little bit more uncertain. Obviously, now there was that moment of Mystique masquerading as Stryker.
The Stryker, yeah.
So does that tie her more closely to Wolverine's past?
It could. that moment in the movie, again, it was sort of an exploring this notion of sort of the ripple of how you can affect time and fate. Because another thing that I felt from the beginning is at the end of the movie, no matter what we've done, Wolverine should be on his way, wanting Stryker to be a part of the movie. There's a moment where Stryker sort of clocks Wolverine's claws, gets inspired in that moment. You sort of see the beginnings of what will become the Weapon X program. I wanted him to end up with Stryker at the end of the film, but when we sort of got down the line on that, it felt like such a downer ending, and it felt like there wasn't any ripple, that it was exactly the same. The location of where Stryker grabbed Logan is different, but the Logan's fate was very much the same. And so I felt like we hadn't made enough of a ripple. And from there, I started thinking, well, who else could it be? And then I was thinking other people on the boat, if he's been fished out by Charles and Hank. But we set this thing up at the beginning of the film where, Mystique is masquerading as a military character, saving mutants from going into some sort of experimental program in Saigon. So I was like, well, there's just a really nice symmetry in poetry, obviously, at the end of the movie doing something the same, but with much bigger stakes, given what we know about the Weapon X program.
She was at the beginning playing Colonel Saunders.
Yeah.
Is somebody a big KFC fan?
I don't remember. There was so much practical joking and goofing around on set. I'm sure that came from somebody's goof. Maybe Jen Lawrence. I don't know.
I spoke to you on set about Wolverine, about Hugh Jackman. And my theory at the time was that if you put Wolverine into an X-Men movie, he automatically becomes the focus. And you said, no, it's not the case. This is Charles's movie. And I nodded, but I didn't exactly believe you. You were right. But I love what you did with Wolverine in this film, even to the point where you essentially get rid of him for the big finale. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, well, you were right too, which is when you put Wolverine in an X-Men movie, he becomes naturally, for a mass audience especially, the focus of the movie. And so it was really important to me that he be serving a purpose for the hero of the film. Because if he's not serving a purpose for the hero of the film, he becomes the hero. When we talked about this radical notion of sending Wolverine back in time, the thing that appealed the most to me about it was this idea that I think fell into our laps. This, and I think, is a sort of spectacular idea that Wolverine, a character who was saved and mentored by Professor Xavier, is sent back to save and mentor the young Professor Xavier. To literally use the lessons of that older man to save and teach the younger man is, I've just never seen anything quite like that dynamic before in any kind of way. Literature, plays, movies, comic books, the richness and the irony of that, I just thought was undeniable. And once I figured out that's his role in the film, he could be in every scene of the movie, Wolverine, but he's the coach, not the player. You know? And when you watch sports movies, more often than not, the coach actually is in most of the scenes, but the hero, the one that changes the most, and that's how you define the hero, right? It's not the one who necessarily does the crowning thing at the end, or it's the one that changes the most over the span of the film. Player is usually the one that changes the most, and that is Charles at the beginning of this movie is as far as he could possibly be from being the Professor Xavier of Patrick, Sir Patrick Stewart, you know, sort of dignified, beneficent, saintly leader. He is a broken, drug addicted, dirty, long-haired, angry, swearing, hopeless man.
Can you talk about the decision to have Charles be so broken at the beginning of the movie? And I think a lot of people said when they saw the trailers, a lot of people said to me, how is he walking?
Yes. Well, this came from many, many conversations and months of working with Matthew Vaughn. One of the things for Matthew that he and I talked about a lot before we ever started talking about what the story would be or what comic it would be based on was, who is Charles 10 years later? Matthew really wanted to jump 10 years. That was an initial instinct of his that I thought was really smart and bold, right? Because most sequels take place 2 years, 3 years after, sometimes that, in the case of Bourne, like a second after.
Yeah.
He wanted to see the effect of 10 years on their lives, how the events of X-Men First Class had taken their toll on these characters. The most interesting of all of those was the guy that lost his legs, lost the girl who was essentially a sister to him, lost what he thought was sort of his best friend, and in turn sort of lost hope. And just as we started talking about who that character was, initially he was going to be in the chair, and he was just going to be kind of like born on the 4th of July, angry guy, you know, has to lift himself out of bed every day, put himself in the chair, roll around the house, never leaves the house. And for a few reasons. One of them was a logistical reason, which was that Matthew didn't really want to be beholden to being in the chair for every scene. He wanted to give him a chance. And then the other one, which was more compelling and more the reason we did it, was part of the way we started to describe his arc metaphorically was accepting the chair, embracing the chair. And initially, that was just a metaphor. And then at a certain point, we were like, well, what if we actually give him that arc literally, such that he is not in the chair? We figure out some machination, which we figured out with the Beast, you know, cure thing is sort of contrived. But if you believe it, it works. And in turn, have that be connected to his wanting to retreat from being a mutant. So that it's literally like, I don't want anything to do with this mutant cause. I don't even want to be a mutant anymore. I just want my legs and to be left alone. I want to be a man, and I want to be left alone. And that, again, it just sort of built the rich tapestry of this character and gave him even more arcing to do. So there's sort of the middle of the movie when he says, get the chair out of the closet, you know, and the end of the movie is you feel like he's being held up by Beast, you know, the very, very end of the film. But you know, just because you know he's going to become Professor Xavier, he's going home to get a new chair.
Just on the timing of that, because there was some discussion about this in the office today, it's not immediately after First Class, is it, that he sort of immediately, you know, falls apart? There seemed to be like there was a mention of it, sort of a little bit of time where he was kind of holding it together and
That's
then kind of gradually lost it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just because people had been confused.
Well, it's pretty confusing. At the end of First Class, there's a little button scene between him and Moira, Rose Byrne, in front of the house, and he's in his chair, and it seems like he's excited about potentially starting the X-Men. I mean, the way they're phrasing it is a school.
Yeah.
And then in the movie, Nick Holt has a monologue when Charles is upstairs shooting up about, you know, it was so great, we started the school. For a while, things were going so well, but then the Vietnam War started in earnest, and they took a lot of our students, took some of our teachers. It was too much for him. He'd lost Eric. He'd lost Raven. He'd lost his legs. Now he was losing the school, too. And he became the drug addict you see before you.
Good. That's what I said.
Yeah, look at that. Well done.
Obviously, you're going to have your core quartet coming back from First Class for this one. You also bring Havoc back for a short burst. Otherwise, you're very brutal with what happens to the survivors of First Class. I mean, we see Azazel's corpse at the hands of Trask. We see Angel's dead as well. And Eric mentions the likes of Banshee and Emma Frost as well. Again, how detailed did you go in terms of what happened to people and the nature of their demise?
We went pretty detailed in that there was a draft I wrote at one point of the script where you saw actually Havoc and Angel running through the woods in what was an experimental attack by a Trask sentinel. Mm-hmm. So it was the first time you actually saw a glimpse of the Sentinel, and they were like taking them out to some forest where they were running Sentinel program tests on them. We cut it before we ever shot it, I think probably for budget reasons, to mm-hmm. be honest, and also because there's so much story to tell in this movie. Mm-hmm. Anything that you can tell concisely, you do. And also for me, anything that isn't really pushing the main story and the main characters forward, mm-hmm. you know, got cut, even in the case, obviously, of the Rogue mm-hmm. subplot. It was, we talked in some detail about what happened to them. For us, each of them got rounded up, found, and experimented on, and in the process killed by Trask Industries. But we even had these other sort of detailed backstories for them, where a couple of them got drafted or were fighting in Vietnam, and that Trask was going around Vietnam and finding soldiers who were sort of super skilled soldiers, or soldiers who had like almost an unnatural amount of kills. And he would test to see if they were mutants and then put them on a ship and take them to the lab.
Very clever.
Fiendish.
Yeah. Clever, yes. Trask. Trask's an interesting villain because I think the casting of Peter Dinklage was a masterstroke, because no matter how officious his rhetoric against mutants gets, I felt myself him not wanting him to die, which is, again, quite the juggling act.
Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with the casting, but it's critical to the movie that you don't want him to die.
Yeah.
Because in most movies, the culmination of an action movie is the villain gets killed. Mm-hmm. And the culmination of this is, oh, I hope she doesn't kill the villain. Because if she kills the villain, she sets the future on a dark path that leads to, you know, sort of mutant and even human apocalypse, for lack of a better word. So it was crucial that we had a villain who felt complicated and sympathetic enough that you weren't sure how you wanted the movie to end for him. And Peter does that. Very small amount of that is in the writing, because I tried to give him a philosophical underpinning and justification for what he was doing. Really, mostly it is the sort of humanity that Peter has, that he brings to any part he plays. I mean, obviously, this is true on Game of Thrones. Mm. He can do the most dastardly things, and yet there is some part of all of us that loves him on that show more than any other character.
You mentioned the word apocalypse. You know, there is that post-credit sting with En Sabanur, mm-hmm. Which got everyone excited. Now, first of all, a very quick question, the sort of the physicality of apocalypse there, that looks like a young man.
Yeah, that scene is really just a little tease into the backstory of what the movie will be. We're not committed to that young actor playing Apocalypse of our film. It was just supposed to sort of let the hardcore fans know it is Apocalypse.
He's coming.
And if you see in the background of that, actually, there's four horsemen in silhouette.
Very good.
Yeah, right off to his left. It's something it's worth looking at.
Seeing it again tonight. I'll check
it out. Because that was something that was important to Brian, and he did a really nice, really subtle job of weaving them into the shot. But the kid that you see there is just this sort of, I guess we call him the early Apocalypse.
Yeah.
And the Apocalypse that will come in the movie will be a different actor and slightly different vibe.
So how do you, now this may be the kind of question you can answer, but I'm hoping you can explain a little bit anyway. The Age of Apocalypse, the storyline in the comics tended to revolve around alternate realities. Having just done this time travel and this sort of reality reset, presumably you've got to take a slightly different approach.
Well, I'll be vague about it.
Sure.
As a writer, I'd rather not have to do alternate reality again. And I feel like, we really committed hard to that in Days of Future Past. And one of the things that I know all of us, Lauren Schuller Donner, myself, Brian, the studio, wanted to be able to do with these movies is make them fresh and different every time. And in a way, also almost create a different genre within the genre each time, which my favorite superhero movies do. Like Days of Future Past is a time travel movie. Apocalypse is a disaster movie. And those are, you know, viable genres without superpowers.
Yeah.
And when you add superpowers and comic book heroes to that kind of a genre, suddenly you have something that feels a little different than the superhero movies that have come before it, you know? So in terms of the alternate realities, you know, there may be a little bit of that in the film, but we really are still at the early stages of figuring it out. I will just say, as the writer, I don't know if I could handle having to tell more than one linear story anytime soon. And that one linear story being, you know, still eight characters.
Yeah.
You got to service. I look at some movies now, like, I won't name names, but like, you know, single protagonist action movies. And I'm like, that is the easiest job in the world. Like that is literally like, I could do that and I can't, because it has different challenges. You have to go deeper and you have to actually stretch further with the character. But But yeah, it's I do yearn for the day of one hero with a set of problems.
The post-credits thing is very interesting as well, because you see Ensabanur so nonchalantly building the pyramids.
Yes.
And you think, oh, that's a level of power we haven't seen in this franchise before. And you said disaster movie, Brian, in the past, has said that we will have city leveling action in this one. So is this going to be the biggest X-Men movie?
Yeah, I think from a standpoint of scope and scale, visually, it'll be the biggest X-Men we've ever had. One could argue Days of Future Past is the biggest because of the cast. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have every member of the X-Men in the history of the films, but we will have some new X-Men that will give it its own unique flavor. And because it takes place years after Days of Future Past, there's an opportunity to start to tell origin stories of other characters we haven't told yet. But for sure, Apocalypse is going to be, from a visual and powers perspective, the most powerful villain the X-Men have ever faced.
And then, of course, there's Eric running around.
Yeah,
as well.
Got that.
If First Class was Eric's story, Days of Future Past is Charles's story, have you figured out who Apocalypse's story is yet?
Well, in a way, and it's an sort of ambitious thing, I think it's both their stories. Mm. Like, I actually think that if the first movie was about Eric becoming empowered, because that's what it was. It was a guy at the beginning who actually couldn't fully control his power. You know, that movie to me, when you look at the poles of it, it's for a guy who can't stop that submarine from getting away to a guy who lifts that submarine out of the ocean and throws it onto a beach. That's the origin story of a man's power. Days of Future Past is a guy who, you know, is a mess and can barely get up out of bed in the morning, you know, becoming the guy who essentially emotionally masterminds the whole end of this massive movie. So they are both sort of at their peak powers starting Apocalypse. And so Apocalypse to me is the sort of culmination of this love story. It's sort of a three-act story.
Without going too much into detail, obviously, have you reached, for example, page 13, Charles scratches his head, pulls his hand away, and there's a clump of hair in his hand? Or
well,
are you going to address the hair thing at any point?
An early draft of Days of Future Past, I had his hair coming out, and he was noticing more and more of it come out. But, you know, in Days of Future, it felt like so many things were happening to him. It almost felt like we were creating, like, The Fly, where it was like, you know, it was this, like, body horror movie. So we pulled it out for good reason. But sure, it's something that we've all talked about since First Class, actually. How do we eventually get the hair off of James's head? This movie went in the opposite direction.
So I have a very quick hair question just while we're on the subject. While Magneto's in prison, he's clean shaven and has short hair,
yes,
but they can't let metal anywhere near him, so I'm wondering how they do that.
These are the kinds of questions that people ask on set all the time. No, seriously, for real. Because Michael asked that question. We were told that you can actually have a plastic razor, and that they would come with plastic scissors and a plastic razor, and that once a week they would clean him up.
Okay.
But it's the kind of those kinds of logic, like nitpicky logic questions. There's someone on set, on the crew, or more often than not the actor, that asked that question. And I think, by the way, in the case of Eric, we did talk at one point about a beard, having him have a big scraggly beard, but we would have had to put a fake beard on him because the way we were shooting, and fake beard just looked fake always. And it still runs into somewhat of the same question, unless he has like a Rip Van Winkle, like down to his knees beard. You know, he's been in prison for, what is it, 62, you know,
10 years.
Yeah. Mm. At some point, somebody came in and shaved a little bit.
And who stopped him from stopping the assassin of JFK? Do you know?
Well, the notion was that actually Trask was a little bit involved in that too. That he knew that there was this power. That Trask was involved with the people who actually killed JFK.
Ah.
Because this is all, I'm just telling you backstory. It's not
sure,
in the movie.
Yeah.
But it's that Trask identified that JFK was a mutant. And then the people that wanted JFK killed for all the political reasons they wanted him killed, who are the people, whoever it is that actually killed him, were motivated also by the fact this guy is a mutant. And Eric got wind of that, and Eric went there to try to stop them, but there were too many of them.
Right.
Had you figured out what JFK's power was?
So funny, you know, we talked about that quite a bit, and I have a vague answer for that that's really obvious and not that smart, but it's a telepathy, it's a mind control.
Okay.
The ability to persuade people to do things just feels organic to him.
Super charisma kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were other theories from other people that were slightly more tawdry.
I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine somehow. Simon, we'll have to let you go, but I just looked up a couple of really, really quick questions. You mentioned Rogue.
Yeah.
And you said the Rogue subplot that went because it wasn't driving the main story. Mm. What was it, can you say?
Yeah, it first came from the fact that I personally just wanted a mission that was a old Charles and Eric mission, an Ian Patrick mission, where they go off on their own and they do something, and it's sort of like their last, like two gunslingers, like Unforgiven, like Clint and Morgan Freeman, that kind of a mission for them. And I just loved the idea of that. It did not fit the story. Nothing in the story necessitated it. Just as a lark, I thought it was a cool thing to see, because we may never see it again. So I wrote that. And initially when I wrote that, it was Kitty's power was running down, and there were like the super silly, like power up kind of serum that were down in a farmhouse, and they had to go down to the farmhouse to get it. It was terrible. I don't even know if it went to script, but it was in the outline. And Matthew said it was terrible, and he was right. And then I thought, well, her power's winding down, and what they need is someone that they either need something that can make her powerful stronger, or someone that could take over her power. And literally, it came from a conversation, I think with it was Matthew, where he said, well, nobody has the same power as her, right? I was like, no, nobody has the same power as her, but there is someone that can take people's powers. So then I was like, ooh, okay. Now this, I got chills, and I was like, that it can be Rogue. The MacGuffin of that mission can be, they have to go, you know, get Rogue out of some prison or some, you know, dark, scary place. And that's what happens. It's like they go to get Rogue to try to bring her back in time to take over for Kitty. It's a really nice sequence. It'll end up on a DVD or Blu-ray or something somewhere down the line, some technology they haven't invented yet. It does not service the main story. And it actually, what I thought it would do would be that to increase the urgency and the stakes of the plot in the future. But what it does is does the opposite, because you feel like there is an answer out there. You feel like once Rogue gets here, then we'll have unlimited amounts of time. You know?
Yeah.
And so the ticking clock that we've established with Kitty getting wounded and Kitty starting to really like lose her powers gets like Rogue shows up basically and presses stop on the clock. And so for all of those reasons that were just narrative reasons, and it was a 10-minute subplot, you know, in a movie that wants to be driving forward and has so many stories to tell, it had to go.
Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Very nice man. Really enjoyed that interview, Hell's Bells.
Yes, he was on great
form. Captain Empire.
Thank you.
But we didn't have enough time with Simon Kinberg, sadly. We didn't get a chance to ask him everything about the film. Didn't even mention Quicksilver, for example, who has one of the key sequences in the movie. So I emailed Kinberg after the podcast, asked him some more questions, and he was gracious enough to answer. So here are his answers, as detailed as he could make them, because he's in Moscow at the moment on the X-Men tour, or he was at the time. This is like a week and a half before you listen to
what
this.
What if we spice this up and I ask the questions and you do the answers?
Okay. Can you do that?
Wow, role play.
Ooh, wow, it is.
Do you want me to move?
That's fine. Okay.
Okay. Ready?
Question number one. Let's talk Quicksilver. Here, he's Peter Maximoff, not Pietro. Why did you and Brian take that decision, and how hard was it to shape his personality? He's much more sullen in the comics, or can be.
This is actual Simon Kinberg stuff. When we meet him in the film, he's living in a US suburb, so we thought a real teen kid would go by Peter. It came from a place of asking what the character would really do. Brian, Singer of course, is first and foremost a character-driven director for all the visual effects and action of the film. Brian brings a real sensitivity to character. He asks questions that not all directors do, and he wants to know all the details of these human beings before they come to life on screen. His personality was something we talked a lot about. We liked the idea that he sort of strings sentences together. He doesn't work in the same rhythms as the rest of the world. And we did make him defiant and a little standoffish to the X-Men when they first arrive at his house.
Question number two. We love the nod to Magneto being his dad. Was there anything more overt than that at any point?
Kinberg voice. No, we just wanted to plant the seed in this film. I love Fassbender's reaction to that line. It's subtle, but clear enough to register even for non-fans in the audience. It's funny because the movies have never really explored the sexual life of Magneto. Even First Class was more focused on Charles as a ladies' man at the start. There's one failed allusion to Magneto / Mystique in X2 when he responds to the line, "She's good with, you have no idea." But still, that's pretty oblique. We go a little deeper in this film.
Question number three. A number of people have asked why Charles, Hank and Logan didn't take Peter with them to Paris. Was that discussed? Is Peter, in a way, too powerful to have around for the whole movie?
I love that people are asking this question because I think it comes from people loving Evan/Peter in the film. Evan Peters/Peter. It was just a story decision. They go to Peter to help him with one mission to break Eric out of prison. He completes the mission, so he's done. For this film. ...
Question number four. We didn't talk about the decision to have the future Sentinels derived from Mystique's DNA. When did that occur to you and why?
First of all, thank you. It's always scary to introduce big news story ideas into these movies because you don't want to stray from the books when it's not absolutely necessary. Early on, in the conceptual stage of the script, I knew the MacGuffin of the movie was going to be Raven. The plot revolves around stopping her from assassinating a target, but that felt vague to me and less urgent because it led me to questions like, why don't they just warn Trask or grab him? And there was something too cold and plot-driven about simply stopping Raven from committing an act. It felt much more emotional for them to be saving Raven, the woman they all loved, in one form or another. So he kind of answers it and doesn't really answer it.
Question number five. Towards the end, as the Sentinels kill Sunspot, they seem to manifest attributes we associate with Emma Frost, Darwin, and even Lady Deathstrike. Can you talk about that?
That was intentional. Smiley face.
Question number six. Who's the mutant girl in the little pink hat in the school? You see her in Professor X's idealised dream of his school that he shows Charles, and also in the happy, happy future. She looks like she's from the olden days and is vaguely familiar, and it's kind of annoying us.
I'm not going to tell you. I'll just let it torture you.
God, this guy's great. Question number seven. Was there more Storm in the original cut slash script?
There was a little more, but we always knew she wasn't going to be one of the main characters of the movie. This is really the story of Charles, Eric, Raven, Hank and Logan. I adore Hallie as an actress and a person, and I hope we'll get a chance to go deeper with Storm one day.
And the final one here. We see that Trask is arrested at the end. What do you think he does next?
Kimberg voice. I think he ends up in a prison cell, a lot like the one Eric was being held in at the beginning. A lot like it. And back to Hewitt voice, which is the same as Kimberg voice. Interesting enough, whenever we were putting our feature together, our amazing 25 covers, extraordinary X-Men Days of Future Past coverage, we were given a look at a number of photographs from the movie. And one, we were going to run one, and then Bryan Singer decided that we couldn't use it because it would be too much of a spoiler, and it was Peter Dinklage as Trask in a straitjacket, which presumably was going to be at the end of the film.
Yeah.
There's a small hint at the end of the film. You see a newspaper towards the end of the film which says Trask has been arrested for selling military secrets, and so who knows, we might have got just a little glimpse, a little brief shot. But there you go, that's Simon Kimberg. We asked him some other stuff, but he didn't have time. Like I say, he's on the X-Men press junket, or was at the time of answering the emails, so he didn't have time to answer everything. But fair play to him for taking time out to answer the ones we did post to him. So, now, it's time for us to tuck into the movie, which I loved. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I've seen it three times now, Helen. What about you? How many times?
Twice, yes. Very, very. I like it very, very much. Mm-hmm. I have maybe a couple of reservations that you don't necessarily share, but generally speaking, I thought it was one of the best summer blockbusters in ages.
That's what we're here to talk about. This is the point of a spoiler special. Jimbo, what did you think of it?
I liked it very much. Unlike Helen, I had no such reservations. It's definitely my favourite blockbuster of the year so far, and I suspect will remain so until the end of the year.
And editor?
I liked it a lot too. I feel like it's one of those films that as soon as you finish it, you really look forward to seeing it again. And I haven't had that for a while with a big blockbuster. I tend to have that with more kind of, dare I say it, discerning art house fare where I go, oh, I'm going to look forward to watching this again. But as soon as it finished, I went, can I wait for the next screening? Can I just sit here? Which is always a good sign. And there's just so much going on. I almost don't know where we're going to begin.
Yeah, this is why I'm asking people what they thought of the film, because I don't know where to begin.
What really impressed me about this film is there are four characters, I feel, that actually get an arc. We were worried about this film having too many characters, as you would be. We had 25 covers. So how do they pull off that trick? Well, it seems to be by, understandably, leaving certain ones totally to one side. Toad, blinking you'll miss him, no pun intended for Blink as well. Like there are relatively small parts, but four characters get big arcs. Magneto, Professor X, Wolverine to an extent, and Mystique all get time.
I disagree on Mystique. That's my big reservation.
I felt like I understood that she was going through something more than the others. But I know what you mean. She certainly gets the smallest of those big four.
That's differentiated here by doing what Simon Kinberg does and call Charles and Eric for Fassbender and McAvoy. I might need a Professor X for McKellen and Stewart.
Ah, that's clever.
Just to make sure that people know who we're talking about at any given time. There's a lot of things I love about this film in terms of, I think it's a phenomenal scripting achievement in many, many ways. Kimberg told me when I was interviewing him for the feature that he broke it down into incredibly detailed time streams of where everyone was and everyone's arc, and by the end he looked like a madman, in something like Seven or an episode of Criminal Minds, with like bits of paper and post-it notes and string all over his his writing room. So, but for this movie to come out as coherent as it does, I mean, we have very few quibbles with the time travel-y-ness, I guess.
No, I don't think we do. I think what's interesting as well about the time travel is I came out of this and my initial reaction was, look at the balls on Bryan Singer. He has basically written out of existence every single X movie that he didn't direct. And then I thought about it some more and I realised he hasn't. He's written out of existence all of the X movies, including the ones he directed, with the exception of First Class and now this. Mm-hmm. He's changed 50 years of X history. And that's a really interesting thing to do. So now we have this, you know, time-travelled Wolverine who remembers all the original stuff that we also remember. And everybody else has experienced something quite, quite different.
I think it's a particularly deft Ratnerectomy, and I think it's very akin to what JJ did with the first Star Trek, where you don't want to tread ground that someone else has trodden. You may not like the ground that they've trodden, or you may, but you go back and you change everything, blank canvas, do what you like. That means he can now go wherever he wants.
You say that, but one of the things that gave me the biggest smile, I had several really big smiles during the film. That sounds terrible, but I when you see Beast as Kelsey Grammer, you go, touche. You went, that's a fillet that I liked. That's a tiny slither of that film that I did enjoy. Taking a bit of that.
Well, I mean, same with Ellen Page. She was an X3 edition. There are bits of X3 that I think we all like and don't hate. Those pieces of casting among them. But yeah, everything else, thank goodness, is now jettisoned.
Yeah, but I agree with James. It is very much the Star Trek gambit. Yeah. In that the X-Men movies, X1, 2, 3, and the two Wolverine films, if you like that sort of thing, are still available and still work and are still fine. And they're just on a different timeline from the way this universe now.
So Wolverine Origins has been cancelled too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it takes place after this one. It has to happen.
I know that's the one that's closest to your heart.
Yeah, of course.
It's
it's just because you said the word gambit and I went, hang on, wait.
Well, presumably that's how they're going to get away with casting Channing Tatum.
Because it's a new human being.
It's a new human being. It's completely different. Maybe his, his mum or dad hooked up with a different person. And,
yeah, quite. Yeah. Magneto. Eric. With how we see the end of the film, this is the biggest question for me. As soon as I left, I was trying to unpack it. You just go to the loo and end up just washing your hands for 20 minutes going, wait, how did you... So with that, hang on. At the end, when he wakes up in this new future timeline and all of the people that we've just discussed, plus... You know, Jean Grey and Cyclops, they're all there. And
it's amazing to see Cyclops back. That
it's just, that's another big smile.
So
just
happy.
So many people in the cinema just really, really happy. Does this not mean, to an extent, that because we know in the future everything's going to be fine, that the follow-up films to this, including Wolverine 3, which presumably will come after... I have no idea, actually.
Wait, yeah, Wolverine 3 could come after the end of this film. So I think that one, presumably, we don't know yet, but that one presumably is off on its own. But yeah, Apocalypse, there is that risk. But then they've had that with the last two films. They've had that problem of how do you create tension and create drama when we know that Professor X survives, we know that Storm survives or whoever. But of course, I mean, in the ultra-happy ending, we didn't see everybody. We didn't see Magneto, for example. So there is still room for
who don't we
casualties.
See, just on this topic, if you'll indulge me.
Well, we don't see Magneto, we don't see Mystique, we don't see Nightcrawler at any point. No. Basically just those two. It's basically just sort of the baddos, if you will, if Mystique's going to go that way. Simon Kinberg mentioned that there was a big subplot where Magneto and Bobby go off to find Rogue and bring her back. And he didn't say how that subplot ended. He said it'll wind up in the DVD one day. But I wouldn't be surprised if Rogue died in that sequence, because otherwise that's the only way you can cut the story. It's the only way you can cut it from the film, because it doesn't affect the main story. They go on a mission, they fail on a mission, they come back, so you can cut it without really missing a beat. But for me, there was a... Whenever we first see Bobby appear in the movie, he slides past Kitty, and they have a moment, and they're clearly a couple in this reality. But obviously, I think in that sequence, he goes back and finds his former love, Rogue, and she maybe dies in front of him, and he's a bit torn up about it all. So I think it was almost righting the wrongs, almost putting those two together at the end of the film. It was a nice little touch.
Also, it's just right. I mean, Kitty should be with Colossus. I have strong feelings on this.
I have a question. Yes. Indulge me. The future section, as appears at the beginning of the film, is the Ratniverse. Yes?
Calling it the Ratniverse is a bit harsh.
I'm calling it the Ratniverse.
Okay.
Professor X is there.
Yes.
I refer you to the end of The Last Stand.
Well,
I refer you to the post-credit sting at the end of The Last Stand.
Yeah, but remind me, that isn't there like a body swap thing going on
there? Yeah, so he jumps, his consciousness jumps into the mind of a permanently comatose bald man somewhere in Scotland. Be careful, James.
That's my mutant name. I am Professor X.
I thought you were permanently comatose bald man.
Yeah, okay. But, that's less catchy.
I think what's meant to have happened there is that, I don't know, morphic resonance, plastic surgery turned him into himself.
Uh-huh. It's the same thing. People, whenever we debuted to cover and we had Wolverine, future Wolverine, with the adamantium claws, and people were going, which he has his claws cut off at the end of the Wolverine. People were going, what? How is that even possible? And I asked Singer this on set, and he said, he gets Magneto to build him. He gets Magneto reconstitutes claws. Or maybe there's a mutant we don't meet, like Forge, the incredible inventor who can invent anything, like a lathe. So he invents, he rebuilds his claws for him, because why not?
Or they pull a Lucasfilm and, that's not canon! It's gone.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny how you say that with that Bryan Singer thing, because I remember when I was talking to him for Jack the Giant Slayer, I couldn't help but ask him that, going, so how much attention are you paying towards the Wolverine, Wolverine 2, or whatever you want to call it? And the reaction I got was basically, none. because he knew what he was doing, because he was doing this, and I should have seen it in retrospect, because he was doing the super retcon, he's right insofar as it doesn't actually matter. What he's doing is kind of shaking out the carpet, so, yeah, they can do what they want.
But obviously the Wolverine tries to kind of tee up that film, doesn't it,
at the end? Yes, at the end.
It's a little bit confusing.
Yeah. I talked to you guys about that earlier. Like, it seems to be at that moment, when they kind of freeze everyone and they come into the airport, that's them saying, we can tell now, in 2013, that the Sentinels are coming.
Yes.
And we need you with us together so we can start planning for it.
I think in the original timeline, before they shifted things, the early Sentinels, the original Sentinels, never took off before everything. And they were just developed in the background, you know, in top secrecy throughout the years, more experimentation, more work to try and unlock Mystique's DNA, I guess, Mystique's code, and then it only began to be apparent, you know, that they were really a danger.
Because future set bit isn't actually future, is it? It's very, very near future.
It's meant to be 2023, I believe.
Yes.
Sean Ashmore has aged especially well.
Again, I asked Singer this, and his answer was, because Professor X and Magneto should both be pushing 90 by that point, mutants don't age as quickly, shut up. That was essentially the answer.
It's a testament to how charming this film is. We all seem to be so engaged and happy with it that with other films, I know what I'm like. I'm like, nah, that doesn't work. But with this one, you're so, because they get so much right, and because the characters are all so engaging, and because the plot works, and because it's exciting, and because the set piece is dramatic, you go fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Kimberg even mentioned that when we talked about the serum that makes Charles walk again for this movie, but, you know, loses his powers, and he basically said, yeah, we came up with the serum idea, and if you go with it, it works, I guess, and if you don't, then it doesn't. But most people are going with it, which is great. I mean, even the very opening of the film, you know, you could argue that they don't need to send anyone back in time to avoid Sentinels. You know, there's a line where, when they meet up in Mongolia, where all the X-Men meet up in Mongolia, and they go, so here's our grand plan. Basically what happens is, Warpath, here's the Sentinels coming. I send Bishop back in time a couple of days. Blink, scouts a new site, and we leave before they even know we were there. All very well and good, but you're just thinking, well, if Blink can teleport long distances, as clearly she can, she takes her from Moscow to Mongolia, why not she just transport people thousands of miles instantly once the Sentinels arrive? But you need to introduce a time travel notion, and you also need to introduce a notion, and I think this is very much, quote unquote, no pun intended, a last stand, that they've been running for years and they can't beat this foe, and they know that whatever they do, they will never beat this foe, so it's a desperate thing, so they have to go back in time.
Any line where somebody says something like, the serum affects my DNA, that's a hard one to go with, but I agree, there's so much good stuff going on. I would also like to make a semi-serious pitch actually right now to the likes of the Prince Charles Cinema. It, you know, you've had quote-along screenings, sing-along screenings, weep-along screenings in the case of Les Mis. What I want is a Kiss Him Already screening, a Just Kiss Already screening, which would be any basically scene with Charles and Eric in particular. The audience would be permitted, nay encouraged, to shout Just Kiss Already. I think that would just make it a lot more fun.
Do you think?
Yeah.
For you, mainly?
Well, no, there are so many scenes in this. So many, most of them involving two men, where you're just looking at it going, just kiss already. Anyway,
this is a reading of the film I think I missed.
Yeah, I think so. I thought you were going to say it's a Hugh Jackman ass along a screening, where when Hugh Jackman gets his ass out, everyone in the cinema has to get their ass out as well.
I'll be honest, that sounds like a terrible idea.
That's how I watch them at home, is how people should watch them in the cinemas.
And secondly, I'm sure that any audience that went to my Just Kiss Already screening would actually be cheering that scene too.
Fair enough.
So all these other mutants that we have met along the way still exist. Angel is still out there, right?
Potentially. He could die in Apocalypse, for example.
And we've got, we need to talk about that as well.
Yes.
And we've got, obviously, Nightcrawler, who we mentioned. The mutant that we meet in Last Stand who can...
Leech.
Yeah, who can take away powers. Like, there are still... I worried at the end of the film, they've gotten rid of... Darwin obviously died in the X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Banshee, Other Angel, Lady Angel... And there was...
Azazel, Emma Frost is dead.
Pretty much,
a lot of people from the first movie died. I mean, if Azazel is dead, and you're talking about continuity in terms of the comics, maybe Nightcrawler, I don't know. But I never saw the Azazel Mystique thing as happening in the films. Who knows? Who knows what might happen? But yeah, I think...
Are we running out of mutants is my question.
No.
I'm not saying that in every single movie there needs to be a new mutant, but like...
No, but there does. It's the same thing with an Avengers movie. You know, it'd be disappointing if you went to see Age of Ultron and it was just the same core six plus Nick Fury. You need to see some new guys, I think, just to make it interesting and to keep the toy manufacturers on their toes.
I don't know about the toy manufacturers. I'd be okay, actually, with sometimes it being exactly the same lineup. But having said that, I mean, I think, you can never run out of X-Men. There are hundreds of them. Jubilee, for example, was madly, madly popular in the cartoon series.
The Dazzler.
And has never been on TV.
Because she's rubbish.
She's not rubbish.
She
makes
light.
But people
light.
Love her.
Don't
Dazzler is rubbish. But
Dazzler is
Dazzler
rubbish.
Shoots light. At least she has offensive capabilities.
Don't diss really Jubilation Lee. She's also
a step up from Boom Boom.
I always feel that Rogue kind of took her place in the original movies because of her relationship with Logan. Although she's not as feisty or sparky, no pun intended again, as Jubilee. I'd love to see her in the next one.
To be honest, Logan through the comics has a long, long history of hanging out with teenage girls in a miraculously non-pervy way. Not Jubilee, obviously, was one. Rogue on screen. In recent years in the Joss Whedon run Armor, hung out with him a lot.
Yeah.
He's, you know, it's kind of a thing. He actually works quite well against someone like that. You can just be cheeky at him.
X-Men U-Tree will be the next.
Oh, God, no.
It's just a big brother thing. He's just the wise old grumpy uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Wolverine, Sabretooth, where's Sabretooth? And which Sabretooth is it? Is it Tyler Mayne Sabretooth or is it Liev Schreiber Sabretooth?
I would like to meet a new young Rogue. I would like to see. I've always felt that Rogue should have had so much more. She has the most exciting power for me. I think you can do most with it. And the beginning of this film, let's talk about the opening sequence. It's a stunning bravura display of people's powers, but also setting up the plot at the same time. It's meticulous and so clever. Like, you see each power being used within the context of what they need to do. It's not just a show-off, firework display.
What that does is not just sets up their powers and sets up these new mutants who barely get a chance to register apart from that. I mean, you know, I can only remember Omar Sy, who's a fantastic, fantastic actor. He has a couple of lines. I think he just basically barks people's names. Sunspot.
He makes
Storm.
A lot of them, though. I loved Bishop. I thought he was great.
He was very, very good.
Final moment is fantastic. That's a real money shot when he eventually goes.
When his eyes literally fly towards the camera, which is a kind of weird sort of Raimi Jackson-esque touch in a movie like this. But it also sets up how formidable the Sentinels are as a foe. That they can just take out these incredibly powerful mutants with nary a bead of sweat.
The Sentinels are really well done. I also thought it was interesting that the opening sequence, not the opening scenes, but the title sequence, if you will, of this film. In previous films, it's been sort of a trip through human/mutant DNA. This seemed to be a trip through Sentinel structure with Mystique DNA in there. And I thought that was really interesting. It seemed to be going through the way that the Sentinels are built up and not the way that the mutants are, which I thought was a nice twist and kind of showed... give you a little bit of a foreshadowing of what they could do and what they were capable of.
It's funny because when we released our covers, we put the Future Sentinel cover, I didn't like it. I didn't like the look of it. I thought it was kind of, I wanted it to be chunky and look futuristic, and it just looks faintly sort of reptilian. But actually, when you see them in motion, when you see them working, they really are fantastic. That whole sequence at the beginning, and indeed the one at the end, I think the Future combat shows phenomenal invention on the part of Singer, and I think that's what really sets it apart. You look at that and you compare it with The Last Stand, there is nothing to compare to that, especially the use of Blink, which, as Nick said in his review, it's like she plays Portal in real life. This is her power, and it's awesome.
We saw in our feature in the 300th issue the texts on Bryan Singer's phone where the notes he was writing. And one thing really encouraged me is that he was saying how angry he got that he was getting angry that someone hadn't paid enough attention to a certain detail, that that wouldn't be that way, and you know, that wouldn't have hit that way. And he says our audience really care about these small details, so it's important that you get it right. And I was like, good, because that's what I always really fed off when I was watching these films, is the first time around anyway, was and that fits together, and then they know it's all interconnected. I really, because the world building stuff, you know, people say, oh, isn't it clever how Marvel have been doing it? Well, X-Men world building was pretty fantastic in the first two films, at least.
True, but you have to also remember, in terms of the sort of the massive retconning of this movie, you have to remember that X-Men, the first one in particular, was made under massive duress, and they didn't really know what they were doing, and the studio was very, very heavy-handed, and there was a lot of decisions made 15 years ago that I think maybe Bryan Singer might slightly want to retcon. So that's one of the reasons for it. You know, I think if he had his druthers again, although I did ask him this, he said he wouldn't necessarily change it that much. But I think if he made X-Men today, it would be a different movie. It would be a very different movie. It would feel different, and the relationships would be different. And so who knows? Maybe that's one way of just changing stuff.
A question that I asked you when you guys were like, this is beyond nerdy, is the original Magneto helmet has to be plastic, otherwise he wouldn't have been able to lift it off.
Man, I should have asked Kimberg that.
Off the head of, sure, he does that clever thing in First Class where he takes some frayed wires, peels the wires apart, and then picks up his helmet from his head. Presumably now, you know, at the end of First Class, in a bit that I didn't really like, he suddenly turns up in this really 60s red flashy cape and suit number. It's like,
oi, Magneto,
come here, you big submarine. And, you know, he's just standing there, you know, saying, will you still come with us? Of course, a lot of that all means nothing in Future Past, because all the characters he's with basically are dead. But he does that. Presumably he stuck a nub of metal in that helmet so that you could have that money shot of him going into the Pentagon with the two metal balls. Another thing that I love to see, just the idea of Magneto just walking into a room, doesn't need anything but a small...
A stress ball, basically.
Yeah, basically exactly. A stress ball.
Walking, but then he pulls, you know, the helmet out of the glass. So surely that has to be...
Well, he may well have tweaked it himself, probably adding some metal for exactly that purpose.
Metal paint.
Oh, we see he adds metal to the Sentinels so he can control them. So he's got form in that department. That's
another indication of how much I like this film, is that surely all they needed to do in that scene is essentially there's a bit in the script where they said, right, we need to show a scene of them putting metal into the Sentinels.
Mm. It is important to know that you can reprogram robots with bits of railway line.
Yeah, exactly. But the way he delivers it, the way the film delivers it, is just another great scene. It's like him pulling up railway tracks.
Yeah, and it was classic Magneto, just with those huge girders kind of flying alongside. The only thing I was worried about is the next passenger train through on that line, because seriously, there's going to be a huge rail disaster and it's all Magneto's fault.
I don't think he cares.
Apparently not. Yeah. There could be mutants on that train.
Oh, my word. Oh, he'll be kicking himself. He'll be kicking himself at home tonight. Oh, I could have saved him, he'll say.
We're joking, but his accent's much better.
Much better.
It is, although in the if you look when he's on the plane,
yes,
he's having the argument with Charles, and he says, "You abandoned us," and the "us" is none more Irish.
It's very Irish.
It's very Irish.
It is.
But it was much better. Yes,
much better. Yeah, we'll talk about Charles and Eric in a second. I love their relationship. I think McAvoy and Fassbender are fantastic. I was slightly disappointed that towards the end it became Michael Fassbender's green screen world of fun, where they took Magneto and they sent him... Sorry, they took Eric and they... I'm breaking my own rules. They sent him away and he was basically just on a green screen, seemingly on a green screen for like 3 weeks or whatever, you know, going, oh, move my hand. Do you want me to move a hand left or right? Right, oh, where are the Sentinels? Over there, brilliant. Oh, a stadium, I lift it, brilliant, hey! That's a great Michael Fassbender
pressure. That was amazing.
Amazing.
Do you think the guys, when they were watching Dark Knight Rises, just went, a stadium, really? Oh, we'll do it different. I've got a plan.
I liked it. But yeah, I just think the Charles and Eric relationship powers this movie. And they get those two great scenes on the plane halfway through.
They should just kiss already.
No,
I'm not
Helen.
Even kidding. It genuinely plays like a
romance.
This is
not Captain America and Falcon, all right?
Well, that scene was originally over a candlelit dinner. So.
Actually, it was.
Yeah,
there was.
And they moved it to the plane.
If you read the Bryan Singer notes in the 300th issue, that scene was initially a dinner scene back at the mansion. and they moved it to the plane.
It's all there. But no, the intensity is definitely there between them. The sort of this deep connection. That's what I'm sort of slightly making fun of and slightly not.
I would like to talk about Quicksilver, because when we first saw these tweets, I know this is a thing that marketing people seem to be encouraging now, is that they get a group of people who aren't necessarily a part of the media, but they say, hey, you can come to our early screening, but you can tweet about it. So there are a few tweets that kind of sneak out a few weeks beforehand. Sometimes this means nothing and it doesn't actually chime with what the film's actually like. But in this case, almost all of them were saying, Quicksilver's amazing. Forget what you were thinking about how the look wasn't good. That scene, his scenes, are the highlight of the film. And it's funny how you can have a film which has this amazing opening sequence that displays the fight, you know, the fight skills of these new mutants, and the end, we have two battles at once, and you walk out of the film going, that bit in the middle where a guy runs around a room and touches some soup with his finger, that was amazing.
But people reacted quite badly to that Quicksilver cover that we did. But I think the problem is he didn't look like an X-Men, because he's not an X-Man.
He's a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's it. He's a kid wearing kids' clothes with a kid's haircut, and that's why he looks like that. But obviously he didn't really fit in with the sort of pantheon of superheroes that we put on the cover.
And he was very good. I mean, I know there was a lot of speculation at the time, probably from me, that this was a bit of a spoiler for Avengers, having Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, because it was announced quite late that Quicksilver would play a part in this film and that it would be Evan Peters. But he's fantastic, and if I were the team behind Avengers, I'd be like, oh, that's a really cool scene. How are we going to match/outdo that? Because it's a high bar right now.
Well, they had no Scarlet Witch in the end, though, did they?
Well, they did. Well, you do see Peter at home holding his little sister.
That's his little sister. True. It's his older sister, who, as again, if we refer to Brian Singer's notes for this, he said they did have a line in there about his older sister was upstairs, and then they dropped it.
I'm quite glad they didn't, though, because Scarlet Witch, for me, she is part of the X-Men universe, but she's not part of the X-Men universe, if you know what I mean. Quicksilver is very, very much part of that. He was part of X-Factor for years. I just think, go Quicksilver. Don't bring a Scarlet Witch into it.
Since she undid the X-Men universe, we can
she
do
did.
That.
Indeed.
Precisely, but which is why she is a big part of it, but she's always been an Avenger for me, and I just think, leave that bit alone. Keep it Quicksilver. Quicksilver's fantastic. Evan Peters is great, and it's really, really good.
Yeah.
Laying the gauntlet down for his kick-ass castmate, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who's going to be a very, very different Quicksilver. Obviously, he's going to be a bad guy, but yeah, I'm still intrigued by that. But that sequence is so much fun. But not just that sequence, but all of Quicksilver's stuff, the deadpan sassing that he gives to Charles and Eric, and the effects are great. That there's that lovely little interaction he has with Magneto, who, as we alluded to with Simon Kinberg's email question, is Quicksilver's dad. And there's that lovely little bit where he goes, "Yeah, they told me you controlled metal." Yeah, my mom knew someone who could do that once. And just Fassbender's reaction in that moment, because it's a very heavy role for Fassbender. But he's really funny in that moment, and he's really funny also in the bit where Quicksilver whips him along the corridor really fast. He's about to throw up. It's really good.
Yes, now we actually did some research into this yesterday, didn't we? Because Magneto at that point says, "I don't know karate, but I do know crazy."
Yes.
And we were like, where have we heard that? And we had heard it, to our shame, in Shanghai Noon, I think. However, it is, of course, a line from James Brown's The Payback, which came out in 1973. So it's timely. But my question is, given that Magneto's been in prison for 11 years, 10 years, how on earth had he heard it?
Might have piped in the radio.
Yeah, because he doesn't have a TV. He doesn't have anything. It's just he's literally sitting in a cell for 10 years. No wonder he's pissed off. But,
how are they getting... Okay, how... Did they have radios that had no metal bits in 1973?
They would just pipe it in. Or maybe get one of those guards to sing it to him.
Okay, maybe a guard has been singing it. I buy that. All right, carry on.
Problem solved.
All right, here's a... Well, this blows the whole thing wide open.
What's that?
The album on which that song appears wasn't released until December 1973.
Oh, no.
So, when were the Paris Peace Accords?
They were earlier in the year.
That's right, Helen. That's absolutely right. They were in January of 1973. So,
or it's a coincidence.
It's a coincidence. Maybe. And here's my other theory from yesterday. The guard, the Quicksilver sellotapes to the wall of the elevator, who's played by Taris Tyler, who's Hugh Jackman's body double. I don't think he's his ass double, but he's his body double. He's awake for that conversation, and he listens to the whole thing. So maybe, makes sense, Pentagon guard hangs out with bodyguards. He says that line to like James Brown's bodyguard. They say it back to James Brown. He puts it in the song. There you go. And there's mutants changing history once again.
Okay. I've totally bought that.
That works
right?
for you.
That all works.
That works for you.
When they go and meet Quicksilver, he seems to be not aware of anybody else with the powers, right? Quicksilver isn't aware of the powers.
Yeah, I think this is the thing for a lot of mutants. They think they're the only ones around.
So when his mum said that she knew someone who could move metal, why didn't he say, wait, that's really weird. I have powers. That sounds like that guy has powers. I'd like to get to know this person because I also have powers.
Maybe he thought it was like a Uri Geller kind of a moving metal. You know, maybe he didn't take it terribly serious.
Eric is Uri Geller.
Yeah.
Yeah, but on a massive scale.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Simple.
Hello, American and non-English people. Uri Geller was a kind of two-bit spoon bender who appeared on ITV morning shows
bits
for a while.
Very two
bits, very
harsh.
Very harsh.
Two and a half bit.
No, the three bit. Charles Xavier is basically Darren Brown / David Blaine for American audiences. I think he can get away with like, oh, you can control metal. Oh, yeah, but at Vegas. Yeah, Vegas sideshow kind of thing. Sadly, at this point, James Dyer has to leave us. He has more important things to attend to. Where are you going? Can you believe that? He just disappeared.
That was incredible. The stink of sulfur in here, though, now is really problematic.
Wow. I hope no one heard that door opening and closing, because otherwise that might ruin the illusion. All right, so it's just the three of us left. There's loads and loads and loads of stuff to talk about. We don't have a lot of time in which to do it. Let's talk about Wolverine.
Always a good plan. In specific?
His hair, the way he carries himself.
His lovely Liberty Print shirt.
Yes.
Natty dresser in 1973.
Yeah, very natty dresser in 1973.
There's
really
a just
cool.
Kiss him moment is when he's hanging from the chandelier. The Beast is hanging from the chandelier and Wolverine's on his back on the table. And you just go, Spider-Man 2.
I will say one thing about Wolverine's costume, which we're honestly not going to spend a lot of time on. But he does go off to face Magneto at the White House.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, wearing jeans that have a belt on them and rivets in them.
Uh-huh, yes.
Not his best tactical decision ever, I'm saying.
What could Magneto do? All he could do is just take Wolverine's trousers off.
He could pull Wolverine towards him by the crotch.
Well, I knew we were going with that, Helen.
Just kiss. Just kiss now.
Just kiss it. I mean, just kiss him. Oh, God. Yeah, but I said this to Kimberg in the interview as well. It's like, the minute that I knew Hugh Jackman was in this movie, I thought, oh, it's going to be Wolverine. It's going to be the Wolverine show. And it is to an extent. But it isn't as well, because they get rid of him at the finale. You look back at the film, and really, he doesn't do that much from an action standpoint. He has that scene early on in 1973 where he kicks some ass, which is cool. And then after that, he's a little bit ineffectual, maybe because of the bone claws. He doesn't really do that much. They take him out of the action in Paris with the Stryker flashback. And then during the final showdown, he goes for Magneto, but gets taken out in a very brutal way that I thought was reminiscent of when Magneto stripped his adamantium off him in the comic books.
Yeah, it is. It's seriously brutal, that. And I think actually, and Wolverine is very brutal in that early fight when he wakes up in the hotel room as well. That was a scene, by the way, I had a little bit of problems with, because I felt like it was very telegraphed. They were really making an effort to make everything clear in the script, but it does mean that he says he's from the future about three times in this one scene, which was a bit much for me. But anyway, the level of brutality is high, and they've gotten around it by, as ever, keeping the levels of blood low, which somehow seems to convince the MPAA and the BBFC that, you know, there's no violence going on here, look somewhere else. But it is, I mean, it's really disturbing what they do to him, and especially when Magneto then, you know, throws him in the Potomac, because Wolverine, you know, theoretically speaking, can drown.
Surely that's the only way he can die. I was actually a little miffed when he woke up. I was like, but I need to believe that he can die.
I think it still takes an awfully long time because his cells are still regenerating as they're deprived of oxygen. So it's only after he really runs his resources out that he's going to be fully 100% dead.
That's a good debate. Do you think when he wakes up in 2023, the new 2023, is that because he's died in 1973 and then his consciousness, his body dies in 1973 and then it flicks back to 2023? His consciousness flicks back to 2023? I guess not, because then there wouldn't be a Wolverine
in
2023. No,
it's got to be permanent.
So, but yeah, drowning Wolverine.
So why does it flick forward then?
Maybe he wakes up in the future as that Sentinel begins to strike, and that brings the timelines into focus.
Oh, okay, so there are two Wolverines.
There's two Wolverines, and they said it was when he wakes up in the future that brings him back. And that's when the two timelines snap back into
one. A very good point. A very good point. And the timeline snapping into place thing is a very, very clever way of making sure that the minute he goes back, Ali, you're a fan of this, the sort of chaos theory, the throwing a pebble back in time and changing everything theory.
Yeah, it's very clever. Just need one sneaky bit of... It's what I always ask for. Just give me a line of dialogue and I'm happy.
Line of dialogue, yeah. Nothing you do will affect this future, this timeline, until you wake up in this timeline.
Yeah, they did make those rules very clear and well thought out.
Really,
I mean,
really
to the extent that you can when you've got grandfather paradoxes all over the
place. I actually thought that this was probably Hugh Jackman's best performance as Wolverine. I thought he nailed all the action stuff really, really well. He looked fantastic, both as future Wolverine. Disappointed that we didn't get to see future Wolverine in action. It would have been awesome, because I actually think he's one of the few mutants who could have taken down one of those Sentinels with his sneaky claws.
I did have to restrain a cheer when he first walked out of the X-Jet with a cigar chomped in his mouth. That was just like, oh. I don't think Jackman's ever been bad in the role, even when the film was bad around him, but I agree. I mean, it's nicely played. And even, you know, You've Always Been an Asshole is kind of a callback almost to the first X film, where with the line to Cyclops. So it's a nice balance of characters. And also, you know, him trying to really overcome his own personality in being patient and wise in guiding Charles is particularly fun to watch, because it clearly doesn't come naturally at all.
Yeah, in the scene where Charles finally decides not to take the serum and get his powers back, you can almost see Logan just wanting to grab the syringe and shove it up his arse. And he always has to fight it, going, no, don't use words. Use words, Logan. You know those things with words. They don't come out of your fists. And it's really, really nice. I really liked it. And I liked the bone claws. It meant that he wasn't simply something that Magneto could swipe aside at the end.
It also meant that he wasn't as effective against that early Sentinel when he's fighting that, because, you know, that he sort of jams the claws up into its gun, but he can't just slash through and cut off the entire barrel of the gun, which is...
In fact, it hurts him.
Indeed.
It does.
Can we talk about Apocalypse? Because that's the biggest head-scratcher. You know, when I was talking about washing my hands for 30 minutes, the biggest one was that, because I half know the story. I've spoken to three people about it. Can you guys, just for the sake of the listeners, explain the concept of Apocalypse? I gather he's the first mutant, and he has lived since almost forever. Mm-hmm. You might know him now as his traditional form, which is him kind of as a hulking, Bane-like metal man who is kind of cyborg enhanced with tubes and wires and, you know, metal and stuff. But when we see him at the end of the film here in the credits thing, he looks a little bit like Aaron Taylor Johnson, but with a silver face, and he's wearing a monk's outfit of some sort, and he's putting together the pyramids. In the background, there are four, what I'm guessing are coincidental horsemen.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
Or do you think those four men at that point, who are these horsemen? Who is Apocalypse? Tell me everything.
Well, he is known as En-Sabanur, which you heard them chant at the end. He is certainly has claims to be the first mutant, and he hung out with various heathen gods for quite some time before, essentially, basically, you know, he was around 5,000 years ago in ancient Egypt, knew the Egyptian gods because, you know, they were just on first name terms. Hey, Ra, how you doing? And obviously in this reality, we see him building the pyramids just because. That's clearly a young Apocalypse. I think that's why he's so kind of scrawny looking by comparison. I think he's meant to be, as we asked Kimberg about this, and obviously he is meant to be a kind of a younger incarnation of the character, so they're not completely tied to that look, they're not completely tied to that actor or that physicality. But he essentially went to sleep waiting for the rest of the world to catch up with him, and then awakes in the modern era when there's a sort of a tipping point in the mutant population, thinking, right, now my people are here and I can get on with things, which are evil things that are bad, essentially. He turns many of the X-Men into his four horsemen. Mm-hmm. Wolverine becomes Death. I think it wasn't Angel War. He turns Angel. He basically takes, as in the Ben Foster Angel, not the now dead one, takes him, turns his wings into crazy metal wings that have that fire poisonous darts instead of feathers.
Which are awesome,
but also, you know, not good. And poor Angel's rather scarred by the experience and left all blue and red and stuff. It's basically one of those ridiculous multi-timeline, multi-reality spanning stories that kind of defined the X-Men in the late 80s, early 90s.
He was introduced in 1986 as an X-Factor bad guy. But for me, reading the comics, he didn't really come into his own until the Age of Apocalypse storyline, which was a multi-issue, multi-title crossover, which was just huge. Days of Future Past, a comic book, is two issues long. you look back, and its ramifications really are just contained within that two issues. But Age of Apocalypse was fast and huge and had ongoing repercussions for the X-Men titles as well. But it was also very, very cool. But it was an alternate universe thing, which is why I think Kimberg is reluctant to fully embrace that idea, although there will be elements of Age of Apocalypse in X-Men Apocalypse. But, for example, in that one, there's an evil Beast. Beast is evil in that reality. Wolverine only has one arm in that reality. And again, you have the idea of Magneto as a good guy leading the heroes, that sort of thing. It's a really fun crossover. If people go check out all the trade paperbacks and just familiarize themselves with that concept. But Apocalypse, he looks cool.
Mm. He's almost indestructible, and yeah, his powers are insane. Telepathy, telekinesis, you know, power over technology. His blood can heal mutants. Scientific genius, strategic mastermind, you name it, he can probably do it. Or, you know, kidnap and brainwash somebody else who can.
You'd guess with a foe that powerful that they would have these four horsemen as well, and that's who the X-Men would deal with in this new movie whenever it comes to pass. This is all conjecture. So that there'd actually be foes that they can fight. Because it sounds like if they suddenly meet him, you know, as it's like meeting Thanos, isn't it? You suddenly meet them and go, oh, well, you're squashed like a bug. There's no real...
I mean, the traditional, if it were the comics, the traditional way would be they meet him, they get their asses handed to them, he builds up more power, they meet him again, better prepared, they beat him. Yeah, this tends to be how comics go.
I imagine this will bring Charles and Eric together. I always say Charles and Eddie. Seriously, every time. You know,
would I lie to you?
No, because I'm a telepath. It's like, if you lied to me, I'd know about it. But I imagine that'll bring them together. It'll be, you know, they'll take him on at some point. Yeah, it's interesting because he's throwing as I said to Kimberg in the interview, he's throwing the pyramids together with such nonchalance. You're going, that's a level of power we haven't seen in an X-Men movie yet. Not even Magneto has displayed that level of power. And you're also thinking about, you know, this movie, and Kimberg describes it as a disaster movie, and Singer has already said it's going to be on a global scale where we'll see cities being leveled. So I'm very intrigued to see what happens with this new movie.
Talking about being woken up, I think that works really well, because after the events with the White House, you know, what happens there is huge. Like, if you actually think about it, compared to the Cuban Missile Crisis, where I can see how it was detached from the rest of the world and it wasn't really noticed by anybody other than this kind of military enclave, I can understand how that would be still rumours and speculation. When it is the White House and it is a stadium that's been plonked around it like some kind of absurd halo or improvised fence work, when that suddenly happens, the whole world knows about it. And that for me makes sense in terms of Apocalypse waking up suddenly now and going, hang on, I can sense that there are mutants because I've got a feeling in my waters. So it fits together. Now I know what I know.
Yeah, it does. I do feel kind of sorry for the construction crews and or wreckers who are going to have to cut through that stadium to the White House. And also for, you know, Washington's baseball team who are going to be homeless for some time to come. Oh, well, I guess Magneto didn't think that one.
I guess he didn't.
Through.
I don't know. They could play their games on the White House lawn. That'd be quite fun.
That'd be kind of cool.
That'd be quite nice. I like that thing at the end. I think we had a slight disagreement with this. I don't know whether you'd come around to it, the idea that he's displaying his power. He's showing the world how much power he has. And this is just a glimpse, a fraction of what we can do.
Yes. So this was basically my problem, or one of my problems with the film, was I didn't feel that Magneto and Mystique acted in particularly consistent ways in that sort of last act scene. Having seen it again, I do think that Magneto is slightly more consistent than I initially gave him credit for in terms of his decision to bring the stadium there and make the speech that he does to camera. I still have an issue that with him then still threatening to shoot the president, because that seems to go, actually, that seems to be something that is patently and obviously not going to help his cause. And something that he probably should not do, especially on camera in front of the entire world. I think he had made his point, and that just wasn't effective. And I get that it's maybe meant to be that he's provoked into it by apparently Nixon stepping out and kind of apparently confronting him. But I don't buy that, and I think he should be smarter than that, because he's meant to be an extremely smart character.
Well, you say that, but you look about X-Men 1 and X-Men 2, his plans in both of those movies are ridiculous, ultimately. I mean, he wants to turn everyone into mutant in X-Men 1, and then he tries to commit genocide of humans in X-Men 2. So this is he tries to wipe out the entire human race. So I think killing a president on TV is just a glimpse of what he's
capable of. Given what he knows at that point in Days of Future Past about the danger that is currently posed to mutants, mm-hmm. that's when it doesn't make sense.
But it makes sense in terms of he's got control of the danger, Sentinels. He's got control of that.
At that moment, in that place. But he still doesn't know where Mystique is at that point. Obviously.
We all do things when we're in a fit of anger, you know, when I'm levitating stadiums, and I understand, like, it's definitely a quibble, and I'm sure I'll notice it more when I watch it again.
And also, I mean, and then Mystique's actions in suddenly, and we don't see her decide to do this, we don't get even a hint of her deciding to do this, nor do we get any hint of how she did it, is to suddenly appear as the president and walk out and put herself in danger. And that, to me, is one of the huge problems I have with her motivation and her thinking. We don't actually get a lot of what she is thinking, especially in that scene, and it comes kind of out of nowhere and doesn't seem to relate to anything on her agenda to put herself in danger that way as the president. That's one of my main problems with the last act. I mean, listen, overall on the film, very, very positive. But just a couple of those decisions, I was like, I'm not sure where or why they're going with this.
I think the biggest mistake they made was not sneaking in Stanley in some aspect.
No, I've just written that down.
I was watching that whole reporter section just going, look, I can see how this is tough to sneak somebody in. You've already got Bryan Singer doing his cameo with the old-fashioned camera, which is actually a bit unsubtle, I thought. Half of the screen.
And the guy who walks away, the guy Mystique turns into... in Paris is Newton Thomas Siegel, the cinematographer.
But I will say, cameo-wise, they do get in. There's two in the, I think it's in the committee meeting, the Senate committee hearing at the beginning. They have Chris Claremont and Len Wein, who, of course, in Chris Claremont's case, wrote Days of Future Past, and in Len Wein's case, invented Wolverine. So it's not lacking in Marvel creators, just not Stan Lee on this occasion.
Absolutely. We don't have a lot of time left. There's still... so much to talk about with this movie. Trask, we haven't even mentioned Trask or Stryker, this sort of group of army mutants which involves a lot of bad guys, Toad and Quill and people like that, and Havoc. We see Havoc, and I like the idea that Magneto's speech galvanizes his brotherhood, so to speak, to come into existence. But we haven't mentioned Trask, we haven't mentioned Stryker. What are our thoughts on those guys?
I think Trask is great. I mean, you're always going to, if in doubt, you know, Peter Dinklage is probably the answer. And certainly here he is, I would say, as magnificent as his hair. one thing I was, you know, thinking about in terms of my complaint that you don't get enough of Mystique's motivation and her, what she's feeling. What's ironic is that one of the scenes where you really do get inside her head, it's actually played by Peter Dinklage, just in that little moment where he comes out from his own secret sort of safe and talks to his secretary. And it's pure Mystique, but you also get, you know, him playing her, which I think is great. But yeah, he's not a guy with an unreasonable plan. He's not a guy with an unreasonable belief. He's a guy who is, I think, familiar in his belief from the way that many, you know, politicians and public figures of today act and think. But he's one who is, you know, willing to do something about it, and is, you know, has the capability to do something about it, and therefore is very dangerous.
I like the scene between him and Josh Hellman's Stryker when they're at Trask Industries. And he says, it's just a little throwaway mention to, you know, how's your son? Oh, Jason, you know, who is in X-Men 2, the incredibly powerful telepath in X-Men 2. Just a little nice nod to where the future's going. There's lots of little things, for example, Stryker looking at Wolverine's claws, the bone claws in the 70s, and just little things like that, just setting up where it might go.
It was an interesting thing in terms of the casting that he looks a bit more, I would say, like Danny Houston than like Brian Cox. But you don't really see Danny Houston in this film in the flashbacks. You only see Brian Cox. So I thought it was a nice way to maybe attempt to tie those castings together.
Hmm. Yeah.
Is he related, that actor, to Sean William Scott in any way?
No.
He does look like him
at times.
Because
they do look quite similar. Yeah,
really?
Totally. I wanted him to say Stiflerisms, but it didn't seem to fit the character.
He slept with Logan's mom.
I just wanted Wolverine to piss on his head at one point, but wasn't going to happen.
Beast, we haven't talked about. Nick Holt back as Hank McCoy.
Mm. Rather a supporting role. He didn't get a heck of a lot of time to strut his... Certainly his intellectual stuff got really no time at all, aside from, you know, mentions that he had developed a serum, which then people use for various purposes.
And then him explaining the concept of time paradoxes.
Yeah.
When he's watching Star Trek, awesome. Yeah. Paramount property, good for you making that happen.
One of the things I like Nick Holt in this one, I think Beast is really interesting. One of the interesting things about this movie is that it focuses on the Charles and Eric and Raven triangle again, But you only get that, you know, Hank was in love with her from the first movie and she was kind of in love with him. And you get that scene near the end where they're kind of, they look at each other, and that's, I think that's clearly something that's going to be explored in the next one.
And there is a moment when he's, also when Hank's talking to Charles very early on about Mystique, where, you know, that the depth of that feeling comes through. It's interesting in terms of how much they expect you to know. I think we enjoyed this more than some people will because we've seen not just First Class, but all of the X-Men movies. Mm. And I wonder how it's going to play with those who haven't necessarily been keeping up to date on everything. Yeah. I also wonder how people are going to react coming into a follow-up to this. Now, presumably Apocalypse is going to focus on the Charles and Eric and not, you know, Magneto and Professor X generation, because, you know, time-wise, that seems likely. But if we ever did go back and make a film about, you know, Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, Halle Berry and that generation, and suddenly Cyclops is there and Jean Grey is there, I can see that confusing a heck of a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess. But when Kinberg said in the interview that, you know, there will be some original X-Men in Apocalypse, that's interesting. Also, he did say that it gives them a great chance in Apocalypse, because it's going to be set in the 80s, to have some origin tales. I would be amazed if we didn't see a young Scott and a young Jean.
I think a young Storm would actually make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
There's an Egyptian connection there which could come in handy in terms of scene setting. So I would like to see that.
One thing I want to just quickly get a little bit miffed about, what it doesn't really matter, I don't know why I care, but I do care, but James McAvoy says fuck off instead of go fuck yourself, and it should have been go fuck yourself, and they must have made a decision to say fuck off. It still works, but at the same time I would love it to be go fuck yourself, but there you go. It doesn't matter. The other thing is that they use the bit in X-Men First Class as a flashback, which I thought was the kind of most awkward, brings you out of the film moment of the whole experience, which was young Mystique wandering through the mansion and trying to get some food out of the fridge. Mm. Presumably she'd been stalking his mum for a while, or had been living in the house for a while to be able to mimic his mum.
Well, you see a photograph,
yeah,
on the wall.
That's what
in
she
First
needs.
Class, so she sees a photograph. How then you can replicate someone's accent from that, I don't know. But that scene, pretty much this, it's the second scene in X-Men First Class, but every time I watch that scene where young Charles meets young Mystique, and the young Mystique makeup just looks just weird in the kitchen, I think that's the worst scene in the movie by some distance, and I don't know why they flashed back to it.
I also feel like if you're a young kid and you're like 3 foot, 5 foot, not even that, 4 foot, Mystique's powers are discombobulating brain-wise at the best of times. How can she turn into an adult? Or it just opens up a whole can of worms.
Her powers don't make any sense, because, you know, as you said, you know, picking up somebody from a photo doesn't make any sense. She does this all the time. She doesn't have to touch anyone. She doesn't have to make contact with her DNA in order to be able to replicate them. She can seemingly pull matter out of thin air to be able to, you know, increase her apparent mass. It doesn't make sense. I think at some point you just have to go with it.
Absolutely. For example, in the first X-Men, she replicates Wolverine's claws. Now, yeah, they're not adamantium, clearly, but there's also moments in this movie, I haven't already seen it enough, but I need to go back and see it, because there are moments where she produces a gun as well. I'm thinking, was that gun on...
No, she picks that up from the ground.
Because when she's a Secret Service agent, she already has a gun.
She may have picked it up from
the
guy.
She reaches into her pocket.
She may have knocked out the guy she's mimicking in that case, because she's clearly mimicking a specific Secret Service agent who would otherwise be there. So she may have knocked him out in order and picked up his gun. Let's be charitable.
Let's
and
go with that.
They've thought
Let's
that.
Go with that. But Mystique's powers are interesting, because the idea is that in this movie, her DNA provides the basis for the future Sentinels, which transform and can adapt to any situation. But that's not Mystique's power. Now, I guess it's just a basis for it gives Trask the idea, and then
yeah, I think, and we were talking about this in the office the other day, I think her power is one of several kind of mutable mutants. So I would say Darwin is probably in the same category. Maybe
Potent
Rogue.
Potables.
Maybe Rogue is in the same category, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
And I think if you got any of those mutants and been able to analyse their DNA and just seen how their DNA responds and changes to outside stimuli or whatever it is, that is the key to the Sentinels' powers. So that's why they're then able to... now, they do seem to maybe absorb by touch. I got that impression. It's when Colossus is fighting one of the Sentinels in the first scene. He's in his organic steel form. He punches the Sentinel. The Sentinel catches his hand And then the metal begins to extend up his arm, like he's picked up what Colossus has.
And that's a rogue power.
And that's more of a rogue power. But I think there's a common key. It would make sense if there was a common key to those kind of mutations that allows them to pull in and mimic what other people can do.
I think some people have been contacting us on Twitter, Helen, people mm-hmm. who've seen the movie, been lucky enough to see the movie. They were asking about, A, how Professor X is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And B, why Wolverine has adamantium claws in the future, which is disappointing that we don't get to see him use. I was slightly disappointed that we didn't get to see future Wolverine go berserk.
As someone who stays to the end of the credits for these things, let me explain. How is Professor X still alive in the future? Well, at the end of The Last Stand, we see the comatose bald man who Moira MacTaggert, played there by Olivia Williams, has been caring for. We see him wake up and say in Patrick Stewart's voice, "Hello, Moira."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's because there was a random and completely inserted scene earlier in the movie where they discuss the fact that maybe you could move somebody's consciousness from a dying body into a comatose body if you happen to have a handy patient who had no consciousness of their own,
yes.
Who was just sitting there doing nothing with his body, and really isn't that a waste? So what's clearly happened is that when Professor X was obliterated by Phoenix, he leapt his consciousness into this guy's body, spent a bit of time rearranging things, presumably to his liking, and then woke up. How is it that this bald man now looks exactly like Patrick Stewart? Well,
reasons.
I'm just going to say morphic resonance, because that sounds like the kind of phrase that would be used to explain it. He just does. Why don't his legs work? You don't know what put the guy in a coma. It could have been a car crash that also damaged his spine. So I think the answer on that one is pretty much just go with it.
Yeah, Singer on set, because we asked him about the bone claws, future claws, the thing, and he told me that in his mind, he envisaged that Wolverine approached after the offence of the sting of the Wolverine, because at the end of the Wolverine he gets his adamantium claws sliced off. His bone claws are still underneath.
They grow back.
Because, you know, because he has the healing factor, obviously, but he can't obviously grow metal back because it's grafted to his bones. But Singer's basically like, yeah, I've just assumed that in the 8 years since he's asked Magneto, who can obviously control metal, they found some adamantium, he's put it back in his bones. Or The mutant Forge, who's a master inventor who can basically invent anything, and that Forge could also be the reason why Professor X looks like Professor X now. So let's go with Forge, who then died off screen. But it's interesting though, because the whole bone claws, adamantium claws, people are nitpicking things, people are looking at, you know, and I think they've done an incredible job of making the timeline in this movie work for the most part. But you can see why they had to retcon this thing, because it's filled with inconsistencies.
If you're looking for something that's inconsistent, what you need to do is go back to the very first X-Men movie, where they do an X-ray of Wolverine and they show his claws, and they're clearly mechanical. In that, you can actually see kind of gears and stuff in his claws in that movie. So, you know, if we're looking for inconsistencies, there's one. But yeah, they've essentially retconned the franchise. They've taken it back essentially to zero. The only canonical X films right now are First Class and Days of Future Past.
Yes. Indeed.
I know why he looks like older Patrick Stewart. It's because he has a normal body. This person who was in a coma, his normal body transfers into this person's body. He wakes up and it's fine, and he manages to use his mental strength to awaken him, and it's all great. He doesn't want anybody else to be freaked out by the fact that he is looking like a totally different person. So in the background of all the stuff that he's doing with his brain, which is obviously gargantuan and can do anything, he's making everyone think that he appears this way. That is totally conceivable. And
okay,
he has used that power, at least in the comics, to go, I look like this to you because I have that ability to kind of force your brain to think certain ways.
Yes, so let's go with that.
So in reality, he's walking around like a normal human being, but for the sake of just keeping everyone, you know, reasonably secure, they're going to just make him
seem like
he looks like that.
Are you saying that there's no floating wheelchair in reality? That's disappointing.
That's just showing off, because really that's a waste of energy. Oh. You mean that its resources are precious in the future, and why is there any need for a floating wheelchair? Just use wheels.
I think they needed to retcon everything, because this thing was just, like I say, just filled with inconsistencies in X-Men. You know, and X-Men 2, there's references made to the fact that Magneto and Xavier built Cerebro together. They didn't really. It was Hank McCoy in first class anyway. You know, it's just, it's nice. I think this clean slate is good. Couple of very, very quick last things. The two Charleses scene, the Julian Xavier's, as I dubbed it, I thought that was a really, really great scene. Really shot, really interestingly, very, very trippy, as it should be, given that it's someone projecting his consciousness 50 years forward in time through someone else's body who's just been sent 50 years back. I loved it.
I loved everything involving James McAvoy in this movie, even more than I usually love things involving James McAvoy. I think he's absolutely brilliant, and if there's an MVP, I think it's him.
Absolutely.
There is not a false moment. There is not a false word. He's very, very funny at times, and he is also just... He gets what is an extremely difficult arc, because one of the things I had a little bit of trouble buying in this film is that the Professor Xavier we know has ever... been that far off himself, that he has ever been that much of a despairing figure, that he's ever been a junkie. I had real trouble kind of getting on board with that, and I think that James McAvoy kind of manages to make that transition and create that arc, in a relatively small number of scenes.
Absolutely, he is the emotional heart of the film. It's great to see his scene with Eric on the plane. When Eric basically goes, you gave up your powers to walk, and McAvoy goes, no, I gave up my powers to sleep. And, it's just the way his voice breaks on sleep is just amazing. And I have to say, I saw some people on the internet when the trailers first came out, and he goes, I don't want your suffering, I don't want your future! Some people were taking a piss out of the way he delivers that. In the film itself, in the context of when he says it to Logan, it is truly heartbreaking. I was like, oh, it's an X-Men movie and I'm welling up a bit. What
feels.
The hell? What are these feelings? I don't understand them. I think he's fantastic. Absolutely amazing. And I hope that the next one does have him and Fassbender on screen more often, because I think those two guys together are electric. Just kiss, for the love of God. Right. Are we done?
Pretty much, yes.
Okay, fantastic. That's it for this giant-sized X-Men Days of Future Past spoiler special. The regular Empire podcast is up on Friday as usual, but our next spoiler special will be, barring mutant catastrophe, in July for either Transformers Age of Extinction, that'll be fun, or Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
That will be fun.
Or maybe both. Until then, James has already buggered off. It's goodbye from Captain... Empire? Captain Empire, Helen.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Editor.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me, Hello Poddo. Thanks for listening. Tell all your friends about us, either through voice or telepathy. I don't really care. See you next time.